Bienvenue dans Entreprendre dans la mode, le podcast des entrepreneurs et des acteurs de la mode. Je suis Adrien Garcia, designer et fondateur de la marque de vêtements Réuni. Chaque semaine, je vais à la rencontre d'une personnalité du monde de la mode pour comprendre son parcours, ses problématiques et ses stratégies pour innover et se développer. Avec ce podcast, je souhaite recueillir et partager des conseils pratiques et des idées neuves pour se lancer et réussir dans la mode. Entreprendre dans la mode, c'est aussi une newsletter dans laquelle je partage chaque vendredi des actus, des découvertes et les derniers épisodes du podcast. Inscrivez-vous sur www.entreprendredanslamode.com. Le podcast est disponible sur toutes les plateformes, alors pensez à vous abonner et surtout, bonne écoute. Bonjour à toutes et à tous, bienvenue dans Entreprendre dans la mode. Je suis aujourd'hui avec Spencer Phipps, le fondateur de Phipps. Salut Spencer.
Salut.
Pour commencer, est-ce que tu pourrais te présenter?
Présente-moi.
Ouais, te présenter. Can you present yourself?
je suis Spencer Phipps, styliste mode, founder de la marque française Phipps,
oui.
Phipps International. Je suis américain de San Francisco et je ne sais pas.
Mais c'est très bien, c'est très très bien. And let's move in English now. Thank you very much for speaking in French. But my second question usually is, could you please come back on your pathway and maybe start from the very beginning? Where did you grow up? Where did everything start?
Yeah, I grew up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. In the city. Which was the '80s. My parents were kind of hippie people, very bohemian, kind of artistic natured. My father was an architect. My mom at the time was selling real estate, but has always been a bit of a free spirit in the way that she operates. Sort of making very craft oriented, making furniture. She was big into food and sewing and just very independent in the way that she thinks. From a young age, I was always interested in, subconsciously, I was interested in design and the way things are made and the sort of power of creativity, where you can make something out of nothing. I was a funny kid. I was really weird. I was a ginger with glasses and like super obsessed with science and nature and going to the park and going skiing and building things. I was very like project oriented. I would spend 4 days building a Lego castle and like really intensely taking over my room, stuff like that. As I got older, I kind of discovered the fashion industry a little bit. Kind of by accident. I don't know, maybe it was like once I started getting online, the internet getting into everyone's homes in a way, I kind of realized that there was an industry out there. It was more than just kind of the way you shop or, I was...
Yeah. How old were you when you realized that?
Probably like 12, 13.
Yeah, quite early.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And I don't know, I was always interested in that, a bit the fantasy world that clothing and fashion can bring. I mean, I was also interested in other stuff like music and theater, acting, these kind of, sort of fun, very creative, atmospheres.
Yeah.
So I knew I wanted to go into that direction. Mm. I knew from a very young age I wasn't going to be, a scientist or going to computers or something like that. I started just focusing on the arts and studying things, and drawing, painting. Mm. Went to Parsons. I was lucky enough to get into there.
In New York City?
In New York City, yeah.
Okay.
I got into Parsons. I went there. And then at the end, I managed, luckily enough, to get a job at Marc Jacobs on the men's team.
That's quite quick.
Yeah, that was really quick. It was a bit, I don't know, right place, right time, lucky.
Yeah,
I think
so. You do Person, your first internship is at Marc Jacobs, and you got the job.
Yeah, kind of. I did a little bit of work in school, but like I worked for a stylist for a little bit, little jobs that maybe led me there. I don't know, but I was very lucky
yeah.
that I started pretty much straight after school.
And why did you decide to do Parson? Because this is the only way to fashion in the States?
It's the best school in yeah. the States.
Yeah.
So I knew I wanted to do, I wanted to go to one of the best schools. So I applied to Parsons. And then while I was getting my application ready for, I was going to apply to St. Martin's and maybe Cooper Union or something. I was going to mm-hmm. apply a couple other places, but I got accepted into Parsons.
Okay.
Like 2 weeks after I sent my application in, I got this letter saying you're accepted.
Yeah. What did you have to do to make it in at Parsons?
Like to get in
yeah.
to the school? It's I guess pretty standard art schools to bring a portfolio.
Yeah.
Yeah, they ask you if you're in the fashion program to submit a little portfolio of fashion stuff. I think there was maybe an essay part of the
mm-hmm.
part of the thing, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
And then just like your little yeah. dossier of whatever grades.
And what were you projecting when you were like an adolescent? How do you say it?
Adolescent.
A lad, an adolescent.
a teenager.
Yeah. What were you projecting when you say, okay, I want to work in fashion? What did you expect?
I was expecting it to be a lot more glamorous than it actually is. I think I was caught up in this kind of fantasy of like high drama and amazing, you know, crazy yeah. mm. clothes and this real like fantasy life, you know, I mean, coming off of the height of Yves Saint Laurent and like, mm. you know, Mugler, this was kind of like, or even when I was learning about fashion, it was like McQueen, mm. Galliano, Tom Ford, this kind of huge
yeah.
sex, glamour, craziness.
It was the porno chic era.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, I went through school and okay, school is school, but I was in New York City and was running around and experiencing life, I guess. And I started at Marc Jacobs, and my first week, I guess, at Marc Jacobs was the week before the show.
Oh.
Which is very that. Mm. High glamour, people running around, nobody's sleeping, there's catering, there's models. It's like, you know.
It's a crazy time for the studio, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. So I just assumed that was like every day. That was just how it worked. And then the show ended and it was like, everyone go back to your desks now and get back to real life. I was like, oh, okay.
It's going to be longer.
Yeah, this is a different thing. Yeah, I guess what I didn't anticipate in a way was how office job it is in a weird way.
Yeah.
It's very, not 9 to 5, because I mean, there's depends on the person and the way they operate. But it is.
But for a creative job, it is very 9 to 5.
It's very scheduled. It's like you have like your meetings and things. It's not like being a fine artist where you're just painting mm. and you're in your house or you're somewhere in a studio yeah. doing things on your own schedule.
Mm. And so you were a bit disappointed?
You could say that. I mean, I guess it was just a bit of a, I'm not disappointed because I actually by nature am quite a scheduled person. I like sort of routine. But it took a bit of getting used to being like, okay, so this is when you have to have your research and this is, you know, learning the process and sort of like training myself mm. to almost think in that way.
Yeah. But does this routine kill the creativity or do you think it's not at
necessarily.
All? Yeah.
It can limit some ideas sometimes because sometimes you just don't have things in schedules or sometimes mm. you... I take sometimes a long time to fully
process, yeah.
process or mm. develop something. So there will be times where it's like, I'll work on the season and then like 1 week before the show, I'll be like, oh, wait, this thing, but it's too late. You can't, you know, you sort of move on. You think maybe I'll save it for another thing, but it never really works. Yeah. I don't know. I think at the end of the day, it's not the creativity and the having the ideas isn't the hard part. It's kind of editing them and arranging them and turning them into actual concrete things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes it more of the challenge.
But is it exciting or
yeah.
because having the ideas it's something like okay, it's like a haha moment when you are so excited to have this idea, but when implementing those ideas, is it do you enjoy doing this?
Yeah,
well, you have
absolutely.
To
No, I do. I do. I enjoy the process of, you know, I really enjoy the whole process of designing.
Yeah.
Start to finish. You know, I like the research, but then I also like working with people and turning them into products. And it's a little bit of a challenge to yourself to see how I can translate this rough idea or, you know, something. It's something I read in a book that turns into a thought, which turns into a garment, which then, you know, sort of becomes its own thing.
Yeah.
You sell it, it goes in the stores, and then someone else kind of takes over with what they do it.
Okay. Let's go back to your adolescence.
Sure.
Now, how did you build your culture, your fashion culture?
I guess, I mean, I watched a lot of movies when I was a teenager. And I was watching, I really like, you know, old classic films, things like that. And I spent a lot of time in vintage stores. Thrift stores.
Vintage store. In San Francisco.
In San Francisco. I mean, it's a big California thing. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a, I don't know, leftover from our parents' generation or something, but there's good vintage. It's really cheap. And I would just like ditch school and go hang out in thrift stores and buy stuff. And just, I don't know, put things together. And it was a bit more adventurous. I don't even know if that's the right word for it, but maybe just naive about the way I would put things together.
Mm.
And I just enjoyed dressing up. And yeah, I don't know. I didn't really think much about it at the time.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to Marc Jacobs. How long did you stay there?
Long time. It was like 7 years.
Yeah.
Something, 6.5, 7 years.
So you were specialized in something in particular?
Menswear.
Menswear.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was on the men's team.
So what does it mean to be part of a men's team?
At Marc, it was kind of like being in a separate little family inside of a family.
Yeah.
Because the women's team was Marc and his crew of people, and they would do these big shows, and they were working on this stuff. And the men's, it was this small team that was quite separate from everything. Okay, we showed a little bit with the women's Marc by Marc. But otherwise, everything was just kind of on its own.
Mm.
So it was nice. It was, you know, a way to directly watch a bigger team put on a huge production and sort of absorb that process, but also work in a smaller group and kind of follow that lead a little bit. But still, you know, you could get ideas done really quickly, and you could, I don't know, especially for me as a young designer just starting out, it was a really nice way for me to have input on stuff and have a real direct result. I mean, they gave me a lot of freedom on the team, and I, you know, I could really research stuff or if there was something I really liked, you know, they would listen. Whereas I think on a bigger team, especially when you're just starting out as an assistant, like people don't care as much.
Yeah.
You get lost in the pool of everybody else.
Mm. So Marc at the time was working for Louis Vuitton already?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was going back?
He was going back and forth. Yeah, he was around, you know, he was gone, coming back. It was like a big, it was 2008. Yeah.
2008, yeah, something like that. And what did you learn there? What did you, yeah, what, qu'est-ce que tu retiens? What do you remember from that?
I mean, I just remember that the way that they would kind of talk about the characters, you know, it was Marc as well as his team of people, his stylists, and the people he surrounded himself with were just as inspiring.
Really?
You know, Alistair Mackie or Venetia Scott.
Yeah.
You know, these kind of mega stylists that are just incredible to be able to speak to.
To what extent?
They just have such a huge frame of reference of characters, garments, images, things, and they're sort of putting these little links together between stuff, or taking something and pushing it a little bit further, or trying to make it believable, you know, trying to keep it as something that you understand as a character. You know, I mean, everything at Marc is all about a character, so the way they would talk about this person, it was, or people, or the sort of this idea, this feeling. You know, I mean, they would be like, oh, this season is all about girls on trains, or, you know, I mean, this kind of thing, or you're just putting in, building an atmosphere, I think, and confidently going into that atmosphere. That was a big takeaway for me.
Mm.
you know, because I think at the end of the day, for me, it's always about real clothes. As much as I know I grew up looking at fantasy clothes.
Yeah.
I think it's changed a lot for myself in the sense that I really appreciate quite real things, or at least something that has a level of reality to it. So if you can take a character and push it really to the extreme, but you can still believe it as you're like, oh, that's a glam rocker thing.
Mm.
Okay, then that's great. Then doesn't it really matter what the rest of it is? You know, you don't have to make it something unreal or sort of conceptual in that sense. I think that was the biggest for Mark. That was definitely the biggest takeaway for me.
So 7 years for a young boy must be a life, no? for the first job, staying 7 years in a first job, it seems crazy, no?
Kind of. I mean, I had a good time, so time just kind of flew by. And also, I was in a tricky position because I wanted to go further in my career. I think I needed to come to Europe.
Yeah. Okay.
Because, I mean, maybe this has changed now, but for menswear in New York.
What did you have at the time? What was the big players?
In New York, nothing.
Nothing.
We were the big player.
Okay.
So I was a bit like stuck in a way. Because, I mean, okay, you can go to a big commercial company, you know, I could have Ralph Lauren or whatever, Calvin Klein, one of these things. But that was it, really. So I wanted to come to Europe. And that became really difficult.
Yeah, because when you... Did you came before to Europe?
Yeah, I used to come all the time. I was looking to get a job in Europe for probably 3 years before I actually moved here.
Okay.
And it was this big challenge because, number one, Americans need a visa.
Yeah.
And that is very difficult for a junior designer when you have probably the top five design schools in Europe here.
Yeah, which are?
St. Martin's, you've got, I mean, what's that, the London College of Fashion. There's, you know, I mean, in France you have the IFM, I guess.
Yeah,
I know it is, but that was IFM at the time.
It was Chambre Syndicale.
Yeah, Chambre Syndicale. You've got the Institute, whatever, in Italy.
Ah, Marangoni.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and you see, you just, you have Antwerp, you know, you've just got this like pool of talent.
Yeah.
Every year, people as talented as me, if not more talented than me.
And a lot of American people are studying in the school as well, no?
I mean, and they're, you know, they're lucky to get a job, but what ends up happening to most of them is they go back to the States, get a job at
in very
Ralph Lauren, or The Gap, but they get a really nice job because they went to a good school. Or you get a job at some smaller house. You know, if you do women's, you go and work at Proenza Scholler or, you know, one of these nice, The Row or something, you know, kind of cool New York brands. But there's not like this big industry. You know, you don't have like LVMH doesn't have any American brands except Marc Jacobs. I mean, I don't know, is that true at the time? Maybe not.
I don't know.
But I know Marc, you know, but at the time I think it was like Marc and then everyone else is like Dior, Chanel, you know. So you could see it's like Givenchy.
Yeah.
You know, it's all in Europe. This is like kind of where it's at in terms of creativity in the industry.
So you came quite a few times?
Yeah. So I was meeting with headhunters and agents and they would all say the same thing. It's like, oh, it's
really you're too difficult. Young. Yeah. Too junior.
It's really difficult. You have to basically, what I took away from that was in order for me to get a job in Europe, I had to essentially give a house something that they couldn't get in Europe.
So what did you have?
So I spent a lot of time sort of building a portfolio and crafting a certain taste reference that's very specifically American, that someone from Germany will never be able to really do.
So what did you bring? I mean, American culture is like everywhere, you know?
It is, but that's the overview of American culture.
Yeah.
There's a very different thing to growing up in the States, or at least where I grew up, was very specific. you know, mining the, for example, the hippie movement in a very specific way that's not the Woodstock Festival. You know, which a lot of people might know, or I don't know, it's more personal. It became more personal about my own life rather than referencing culture.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of saying, well, what is my own identity in the industry or in just in general? You know, what are my points of reference? It's like my neighbor used to be like this, so this is something that I know about.
Okay, that's very interesting. So you had to build your own identity and at least to grow it.
Yeah, exactly. And to really stand behind that. You know, I mean, it's one of the things I think I definitely picked up from at Mark also, because he has his identity and his things that he kind of stands for, and his reference points, which are the movies that he likes. It's not necessarily like we're doing this because it's cool or something that's different. It's like, here's the people that I admire. And I'm going to do a collection based off of them. So I started building my portfolio this way, and then eventually I met Dries, and I guess he fell for it.
So Dries Van Netten.
Yeah.
I just put some batteries here.
Oh, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
You
just need to put to branch here.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Sorry, I forgot it. We'll cut it. Wow. Dries, so you can explain us.
So Dries, so you met with Dries?
I met with Dries, yes. Yeah. And at the time they were working, they had one team for everything. So it was like just one design team, and it was men's and women's. A little bit, you do everything. But there was one guy who was leaving the team, and I met Dries, and he liked my work. We got along, interestingly. He wasn't necessarily looking at the time, because he hadn't really known if this guy was leaving yet or what's going on, if there was a position available. And I later found out that they, when the guy left, they rearranged the teams to make a space for a menswear specific designer, because they never had that before. And that's where I came in.
And that's you.
That was me. First American, first kind of full-time menswear.
Wow. Creative. Okay. And what did you like in you?
Hmm?
What did you like in you?
I think he liked my, my points of references, which were very much in line with him, sort of bohemian culture, a little bit. I think he just liked how different it was, but it could be molded into something that he could use. You know, I sort of understand his culture. It's kind of dandyism, extravagance, that kind of thing. And maybe it was just my attitude also, which is
what kind of attitude was it?
I'm quite pragmatic in the way that I deal with people. I'm quite straight up in that sense. Like,
easygoing.
Yeah, you know? Chill.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not like really neurotic.
Overwhelmed.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm not gonna cry when someone like looks at me or, you know, some people are really nervous, especially even at Dries, like some people around him are really like, you know, oh my god, he's treating it very precious. Where I'm like, hi, hello. For humans.
What's up? Yeah.
You know,
let's talk about it.
Let's talk about it. Let's get it done. Here's the job. You know, I'm not so precious in the process.
Mm. And how did you come to him? That was a headhunter applied
to? No, they don't really use headhunters.
Yeah.
I got an email address to somebody at the company, and I emailed them.
Very easy. Straight to the point.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, they're a bit like, we don't know if we're looking, but just come and meet Dries because we don't know.
And what does a book or a portfolio should look like? Or at least
honestly,
your...
Probably the worst person to ask that, because every other portfolio I look at looks totally different than mine.
Okay.
But I think it should just be a reflection more than just the cookie cutter thing. With a lot of schools, the way that they teach you to do it is you sort of do your 7 drawings of a collection and then some mood board things and some fabric swatches and things. I think it's much more free in the sense that when I'm looking at a portfolio, I just want to see how your mind works. I want to see, what your points of reference are, you know, how you think, what you think is interesting. And to more get like a real general mood of what you can do.
It should be pictures and drawings and silhouettes.
Mine was basically like collages of some drawings, a lot of photo references of things, a couple technical drawings. But I brought it all on like an iPad. It wasn't like a physical thing.
You brought an iPad.
Yeah, which I later found out there was some people that found that a little bit like scandalous.
Yeah. Most of the time people say, no, I want to feel it, to see the craft. And
I mean, I'm not a fabric shop. You know? I mean, I don't want to pull out this thing with like 35 fabric swatches when it's a little square and it just looks messy.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather draw it well that you get a sense of like what the fabric might be.
Mm-hmm.
And work on, for example, print artworks or getting the color just right, which I can do more in drawing.
Mm.
Or having a reference of like a drawing and then next to it would be maybe like a photo of a guy in a suit that's a little bit the atmosphere I'm talking about. And then you see this maybe styled differently in a drawing or something. It's a little bit more freeform and allows you as the person looking at it freshly to make your own conclusions.
Mm.
You know, because at the end of the day, when you're applying for a job at a design house, it's not so much what I can do for myself, it's what I can do for you.
Of course.
You know, like I wasn't taking over Dries Van Noten, I was creating his vision for him.
Mm.
So for him to be able to look at my book and to sort of see something that he could take back for himself and say, ah, this inspires me to then build his own collections or to tell his own stories. You know, I think that was, I guess, how that book ended up being successful. Yeah.
And how did you manage that? Because, so today you are a creator, you are an entrepreneur, you start your own brands, but it's a very different exercise to bring yourself to somebody, to bring your competencies and your point of view to somebody, and implementing your own point of view for your own brand. What was your state of mind at the time?
When I started it, you mean?
Yeah.
It was a little bit, an exercise in exactly that, of setting my own kind of rules and deciding, you know, kind of what story I wanted to tell and what are the things that I'm excited and interested in. Just generally in terms of the clothing that I would be really proud to put my name on or sort of things that would excite me as a customer. Building, I guess, my own real identity that is for myself and not for somebody else.
Yeah.
But
what you put in your portfolio when you were going to Marc Jacobs or to Dries Van Noten, it was you at
I mean, in a way, it was very much you. Dries, it was very, very, well, they were both. Let's be honest.
Did you adapt your portfolio to Dries or not at all?
Yeah. It wasn't, I mean, it was more specifically just for myself, thinking about the jobs that I would want to get, which Dries would have been one of them.
Why did you decide to go into menswear?
I like the rules. I like the structure of it. I mean, I enjoy the way that there's, I guess it's like really, it's a lot of rules and the boundaries of menswear, which, okay, you can break, you can, you know, you can do a bias cut dress. But if it's for men, it's a conscious decision that you're breaking these rules. And I get a little bit lost if I have too many options.
Mm.
You know, I'm a Libra. This takes a very long, you know, I like being a vegetarian. You have like three options on a menu and that's it.
It's easy. It's pragmatic.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I like that kind of pragmatism, the idea that it's pants, a shirt, jackets. It's kind of like even fitting into really archetypical garments. It's more about details, proportion, fabric, kind of these more, subtle updates rather than just redoing an entire silhouette.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, it's just easier for me. You know, I mean, I did women's wear in school, but the minute I made the switch, I didn't have to think as hard.
Mm.
And it came a little bit more naturally.
What you decided to work for Dries?
I mean, I admired him. The world that he built, the brand itself, I think was, you know, they always do an interesting collection or is an interesting point of view. I like that he's independent as well. And he was in Europe.
He was in Europe, of course. Yeah. And again, what did you expect and what did you find?
I expected it to be very sort of high level in the way that it was like, you know, I mean, it's a sort of very important fashion brand and it's very creative.
Mm.
And I sort of thought it would be, and it was that, you know, it was very kind of like high stakes. I don't want to call it high drama because I think there's other houses that are definitely more of that, but it was very intense, as in a working environment. It's quite sort of,
what does it mean, very intense?
Like it wasn't to count. Okay. Let's give you a very real example of a counter. So Marc Jacobs, you'd be in the studio and they would be like listening to Lady Gaga and smoking out the window. And, you know, like the head designer is putting on creme de la mer, and it's a little bit this like hilarious thing. And, you know, everyone's kind of laughing along and being larger than life. Right. And then we go to Dries where it's pin drop silent in the studio. Everyone's in like white shirts and impeccable in the way that they dress. And it's very organized. There's lots of space and very like, it's a really different environment. You know, and people are like running to the photocopier to make copies for this thing upstairs where they're going to cut it out and do this very important artistic moment is about to happen. And, you know, I mean, for me, I was like,
okay,
you guys, come on. I mean, it's just clothing. It's, you know.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Which, I mean, I think Dries appreciated in me was that I was never that.
Mm.
And I was never scared of him. I was never, like, running to the photocopiers or whatever. You know, I would do the things. I would get them done in my own time. I would research well for him. And, you know, my...
How come people are reacting like that or behaving like that? This is something I don't understand. I
cannot understand it myself.
Yeah.
Especially when it's unnecessary. I mean, there's some houses that like they kind of call for that in the beginning and you go into the job like that, but unless it wasn't everyone, there was like only some people in the company,
but they were
like really, really thought of him as like, he's God, like, you know, he must do his everything.
But this is quite often actually, because I worked as well in fashion, in studios, in different brands. And you hear about a lot of, director artistic behaving like that, you know, if you enter with a wrong color, he's gonna cry or something. Some very strange things.
No,
you know,
direct eye contact.
what are you talking about?
I really don't understand this. I mean, you know, again, to go back to Mark, I mean, he's the exact opposite.
Mm.
If you're riding the elevator with Mark Jacobs,
it's fine. Yeah.
Hey, Mark, how are you? He's gonna tell you some funny story about his therapist or whatever. You know, I mean,
yeah, he's normal. What?
I mean.
In a way.
He's an exceptional human being, but he's very down to earth in the way that he deals with people.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a little bit of like stark contrast. But I mean, interesting to be in that environment, you know, especially as someone who was not accustomed to that in general.
And Adris, what did you learn?
I mean, I learned a lot about the design process, you know, in the sense that he does a very different thing to Mark. You know, Mark is all about, the character and the feeling and just creating these like larger than life moments.
Mm.
And Dries is also, he's much more of a merchant, I guess you could say. Like he's really like merchandising the collection and he builds things more conceptually in the way that he just sort of lays things next to each other. It's a lot about textile developments or contrasts, things building off of products that have sold well, for example. Much more, I think, in the traditional way that you build a business, you know, because, I mean, Mark, bless him, but he's not like a merchandiser.
Yeah.
You know, he's not really worried about having a nice mid-priced cotton dress. So if it's in the show, it's fine. If not, like, he's not struggling for that. You know, in fact, he might do this season's cotton, next season's all polyester. It's, you know... He swings like a pendulum, which is amazing. But, you know, Dries is very focused on the business side of it and building relationships with the fabric manufacturers. And he's very knowledgeable about how textiles are made and how you can use them.
Mm. But Dries is both the creative and the businessman?
Kind of, yes. He has like a business crew of people. Like there was a CEO for a while. His partner, Patrick, does a lot of the business stuff as well. And then he has like a, yeah, sort of finance team that oversees most of it. But
he's very aware about the business.
He's hands-on
yeah.
the whole business, you know, I mean, sometimes to his own detriment a little bit, you know, I mean, he's in his 60s, he's 60 now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's still going to, yeah, finance meetings and production things and, you know, managing the whole process yeah. kind of start to finish, which was something I definitely learned how that's possible. Because if you asked me that when I was at Mark, I mean, that's, you know, there were 2,000 people in the same building. I have no idea what anybody did.
Mm.
You know, and at Dries, it was like, you see from inception of ideas to the building of the product range to making sure that you have all your sort of customers satisfied. Mm. You know, I mean, Dries builds a collection in a nice way where he thinks in advance about like, okay, well, what's this store going to buy and how is this customer going to be satisfied? And do we have this
yeah.
product for that guy? You know,
he's got a good overview of a business and
yeah, yeah.
step back. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay. The collections are massive, but, you do see how you can build a commercial business out of it. So that was really interesting as well. And then to sort of, because it was a small team to manage all of that and be able to follow it in, all the way through production. I mean, you see, so his whole office in Antwerp is basically the warehouse is the bottom two floors. So you walk into your production every day, you know, you're very surrounded by the thing. If you need to go get something, you go down to the archive, it's downstairs, nice. You know? Yeah. So, and that's, you know, it was much more business, but also with that added creative element, which was really interesting for me.
And you are a bit more Mark or a bit more Dries?
I mean, I would say that's a tough one. I don't know. I feel like I'm my own thing.
right.
But maybe more Mark in the end. Somewhere in the middle, honestly, I couldn't really say. Yeah, because I think I took elements of them both. Like, I definitely feel more Mark in the way that I develop a collection.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Dries in the sense that I can make that something that, like, you know, the buyers will enjoy in the showroom or something that's going to be a nice sort of merchandised collection, really, properly, versus a show. I mean, but the idea for me is to kind of have both as something that's going to make an impact in one way or the other.
Where are you happy at, Dries?
Honestly, yes, and then no.
That's why you decided to leave.
Yeah. I mean, it was cool because, you know, it was an amazing opportunity. Super interesting. I didn't know anything about Belgium. I, you know, hadn't lived in Europe at all. So I was, you know, there was like the first year I was like, whoa, this is crazy. And then it just wasn't for me in the end. Yeah, I started to go a little crazy and I had to get out of there.
So what happened?
It was just too much, I think. It wasn't the right atmosphere for me in the end. And then I started like butting heads with Dries a little bit. And we kind of just agreed to call it before it got worse.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah.
And what has been the process of starting your own business? Because you say, okay, was it something you had in head for a long time? Or
no, not at all.
Straight away, okay, what I do my own thing.
I mean, I left Dries and I had this moment of, you know, I sort of sat around for a month and I was like, all right, let me think, like, what's the next step? Because I didn't even when I left, I wasn't like, I'm leaving to start my thing. It was a bit like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I know that's not the way. Maybe I'll go to Paris, get a job. Maybe I'll get a job somewhere else. I started thinking about it. I even like met with some headhunters to talk about it. And it was just a little bit like, this all sounds a little bit sad for me.
Yeah,
because I think the Dries experience was really intense. And I'd lost touch a little bit with my own identity and with what I was really hoping to take away from this industry and the way, you know, the stuff that I would get really excited about. And so again, I kind of had this period of just focusing on what I, you know, if I could make whatever I wanted and do whatever I wanted in the industry, what would that even look like? Or what company, you know, it's like, let's not even think about a company. Like, let's just, what are the products? How would I want to operate it? How is this going to make me feel good at the end of the day? And then I couldn't really find a company that fit that mold. And so I started honestly talking with, my family about it. And my mom had just sold a piece of property and she was a bit like, I could give you some cash to start it if that would work. And just be like, well, I guess, let me think about doing, you know, let's like sit down and seriously think about it. And then it started to take shape a little bit. Maybe 6 months after leaving Dries, I think I kind of concretely started. It was about just over 2 years ago.
Yeah. 2017. Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, starting a business is something, I mean, you've got to be a bit crazy, no, to start a business.
A little bit, yeah. But, a fashion business especially is, yeah. Like, wow.
But what I like to dig is what made you click and what made you. You say, okay, I mean, starting a business is like starting a new adventure. It's so big. It's so difficult. What's the moment you say to yourself, okay, I go for it and I pour everything I have into it, and nothing can stop me. What is this clicking moment? You know, can you remember this?
I don't know if I had like a clicking moment like that. It was a bit almost the opposite for me, where it was like, oh, I guess let's try this. I hope, you know, like, I hope it works. Touch wood. I hope maybe somebody likes it. I'm really scared. And then we had our first presentation and we sold pretty well. And the response was, I mean, it wasn't necessarily like amazing. But we had a really nice response from people and they seemed to understand it. And some people were very excited about it.
Yeah.
And that was a moment. It was like, huh. Okay. Maybe there's something here. So we've just been building off of it that way. I mean, I don't really, maybe this thing that saved me was that I didn't think about it too much.
Yeah.
I think if I sat down and thought about the stuff I would be doing now, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have started the business.
Yeah. So 6 months of thinking about it. And after 6 months, you start. But what do you start with?
Well, we started.
When you say we.
I mean, it was me and a friend of mine who I kind of roped in to help me at the time. And so we started looking at factories. And we found one factory that could do some like cut and sew knits. So we started working on t-shirts.
Just one t-shirt?
It was like two t-shirts and then we found some sweatshirt stuff. So we said, okay, what about like a hoodie? And then that became a hoodie and a crew neck sweatshirt and a pair of sweatpants. And then we started adding, and then we found a velour and then we found this, randomly met this knitwear guy who made a sweater. So we had some knitwear pieces. So, yeah, we had like a bonnet and a nice little turtleneck thing. And then we ended up just saying, okay, well, let's try and make some like a jacket and a pair of pants to go with it.
Oh, yeah. It was like that.
Yeah.
Very organic.
Kind of, yeah. In a way that it was like, well, okay, we're going to do it now. And now you kind of have a little
collection, yeah.
Collection, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's call it a collection. I mean, for me, it was originally going to be just some t-shirts and, you know, a little bit.
What did you have in the head? I mean, did you start to work on the brand, on branding, on telling a story, or on a logo and that kind of things?
That all happened at the same time.
Yeah.
That was one of the first things we did. I mean, maybe the moment where it all kind of clicked in was the moment we started talking about this sustainability backbone and pushing that to basically be a little bit National Geographic in the form of a fashion brand. And this idea of this like global responsibility and connecting consumers to nature.
Yeah.
And I think once we had that established, as that was kind of the message, I think the rest came quite easily, in the sense that the art directing kind of does itself, and the logo fit the message that, you know, it was all about. Yeah, you know, you say National Geographic, you have a very specific typography or sort of language that's used. So we didn't necessarily have to come up with all of this stuff off the bat. And it just evolved quite naturally from there. You know, there's something weird that I saw happen that was maybe even after the second, or very early on in the collections, you know, in our time as a business, is that people already sort of understand the history of the brand.
Mm-hmm.
That's really weird to say. Like, we're a very young brand.
Yeah. Two years old.
2 years old. But people already definitely have a very deep sense of like the codes.
What are the codes?
There's this kind of educational element, this American spirit, this kind of functionality, which we push. And then there's a definite sense of proportion, but within the realms of reality.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of wild attitude. It's very pragmatic. It's just a very personal thing to me.
This is very you, no?
Yeah, exactly.
It's very American, very pragmatic, very casual at the same time.
Yeah, no bullshit kind of stuff. It's fashion, but not like fashion with a capital F.
Mm.
You know, it's the sort of thing that I think at first glance, some people might look over, you know, because, you know, we sell hoodies and long sleeve t-shirts, but there's a proportion there. We've like worked very hard to build a nice hood that drapes a specific way. And there's a certain length to the fit, or the sleeves are extra long. So it is a very much designed intentionality to things.
Yeah.
And a sort of a subtle exaggeration, in proportions, for example, that make things look, once you have them on, or sort of, you know, once you have them in your life, they definitely stand out. But I mean, if you're standing next to something that's some crazy, you know, McQueen masterpiece, it's going to look like a hoodie.
Yeah.
But I think, people really, people understand, I think, the message in a way that I was not really expecting. Mm. It gives us a lot of, you know, it's easier for us to talk about stuff as well. You know, we can build campaigns, or I can speak to people like at the LVMH prize, I can talk about stuff. It's like, here's projects that we worked on.
Okay. So you're only 2 years old, but you had quite a big history already. Usually I ask this question in this podcast, what have been the different, the big milestone in the history of FIPS International?
I would say, I mean, obviously our first presentation.
Yeah.
2 years, so January, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That was so like the biggest one.
Yeah, what was it? What was so special about it?
Just it was the first one.
Yeah. The first time.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, it was like actually really kind of ghetto. I mean, it was like we just got like a classroom.
Yeah.
We shot a lookbook. We put these photos up on the wall.
Mm, classroom, like, where was it?
What's the school right here? Not the IFM. Was it Champ?
At Champ Syndical, yeah. So, right, okay. Right. Champ Syndical,
classroom. Just in one of the classrooms.
But Champ Syndical, in this street? No.
Yeah, right here.
Ah, the Studio Berceau, yeah.
Studio Berceau.
Studio Berceau.
That's what it was, yeah.
That was in Studio Berceau, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Big up to Studio Berceau.
It was super nice of them. They gave us a classroom. We basically put like some clothes in the corner on a rack. We had a couple models in the clothes. We
put
photos of our lookbook up on the wall, and we had a video play.
Very simple.
On a projector. It was really simple.
Yeah.
Got some beer, had people come and drink it.
That's so nice. That's really cool. That's very nice.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, you know, and that was like, I got to talk to some press about it and really get the word out.
Mm. Did you have a bureau de presse already?
Yeah. Lucien.
Lucien, you broke the Lucien from day one.
Beginning. Yeah. I met him and I showed him a PDF of the brand.
and he clicked and he said...
Yeah, I mean, I think I think he's one of the people who kind of understood what we were talking about.
That's crazy because Lucien is like one of the main attaché de presse in town. So
it's a huge deal. Like, I mean, yeah. I just arrived in Paris, and I don't really know much on the press side of things,
mm-hmm.
so I didn't really understand. But yeah, it was a big deal to meet with him, and he liked it, and he said yes. And
okay, was it a good deal for you?
Yeah, it's great. And yeah, he's been super supportive.
Yeah, that's crazy. But usually in this industry. People are helping a lot young designer and young entrepreneur because we are the future big ones who will pay the rent, right?
Well, and this I've found one of the most rewarding things of starting the business is the people that I've met and the people that have
trust you. Yeah.
Yeah. The people who have been supportive or have even the people who have been not very supportive, just, I don't know, the people who I've encountered that have been trying to help in some way. You know, whether that's just giving advice or they're like, I can represent your press or all the different aspects. You know, I mean, I've made friends with a lawyer who is going to help us register the trademark of stuff. You know, I mean, this kind of very logistical things. It's been really, really nice and a really great way to meet people in France also, you know.
Cool. That's very good to hear. You know, Americans saying good things about French people.
No, I love it here. I don't know. I've had a very, very, very positive experience in France.
Cool.
In general.
Wow. That's good to hear. According to you, what has been the key of the success of this first presentation? Because you sold quite well from day one.
Yeah, we did do pretty well for the first season.
Well, what does it mean doing pretty well when you are on a wholesale model like that?
We had 9 wholesale clients.
Yeah, for first presentation, it's quite big.
For the first one, and good ones. We had like Matches and Essence and Opening Ceremony, for example.
That's crazy, no?
Yeah. I mean, I was very, very pleased and, you know, couldn't have really asked for better. You know, it's the sort of thing when you start a business, they say, you're not going to sell anything. You're not going to sell anything. Don't worry. You're not going to sell. Maybe you get one after 4 seasons. It's, you know, and we went boom, straight out.
Yeah. But what was so different?
What, like my stuff versus someone else's?
Yeah.
I think we got the timing right with the sustainability thing.
Yeah.
We were one of the first out there to kind of fully stand up for this and say, we're going to do it nicely. Mm. That and the fact that it was, maybe it's just useful stuff, you know, I mean, it's t-shirts and sweatshirts and some cargo pants. It's not
too much.
Yeah, it's not too much for selling, you know, I mean, customers can kind of get their head around buying a nice hoodie versus buying some crazy art piece that,
you know, this is very pragmatic and practical.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's that kind of, I always go back to this purposeful, you know, this idea of sort of purposeful luxury and things that are just useful. And the more useful you can make it, the more kind of luxurious it is. And I think people, got excited about that because it's also a break from the rest of the industry, you know?
Hmm.
At least for me, I mean, it's a weird thing to say it, but like in a way, kind of fashion has gone out of fashion. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Interesting.
You know, I mean, yeah, you look at even big houses now and the way that they operate. A lot of it is more product-based or, you know, I mean, like, Celine is very just clothes. It's vintage shop, but with a Celine tag. You know, Dior is the same. It's a lot of, not to say that you don't have that super high-level creativity still out there, and you do, and the people who are really good at it are amazing. You know, I mean, Jonathan Anderson is a really good example of someone who does extremely high-level creativity, sort of conceptual approach to fashion in a beautiful way. But I think for us, you know, we're just a different beast. We're talking about you know, it's just my personal interests of what I like and what I hope other people want. Which is useful shit.
Yeah. So that was the first milestone.
The first one, yeah. And then maybe the second milestone would have been like the LVMH prize.
Hmm. When was that? It was this year, right?
It was like just this year.
A few weeks ago.
Well, I guess making it into the finals, mm-hmm. I think was a big milestone for us. And then maybe the other maybe the bigger milestone of all of that was our show in June. Because it was our first one on the calendar, and we had a good response.
So you sold a lot.
So we did really well. Mm. I think we had a lot of stores that come in off of seeing the show on Instagram or people talking about it. The press really responded well to it. So it gave me a little bit of hope also, just going forward that, you know, it's like, okay, people seem to like this and
so
let's push it. Let's,
we want some more.
Yeah, exactly. You want more? We're going to give it to you. it was really like a nice feedback to hear from people, and a little confidence boost that we now then can push things a little bit more, for January and go for it, you know? And then, we had the LVMH prize kind of at the same time. So I think there was a lot of focus on us as a brand. And I think those were big milestones for me in general. Mm. I mean, the positive ones, at least. Mm. there's been...
Is there any negative ones?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, we've had some moments of just like big learning curve moments of things where you're running up, you get these huge bills for stuff or just errors that I, didn't think about because I never started a business.
What kind of big error you should avoid? You should have avoid?
Yeah. You know, it's like we shipped our whole first collection in these like cotton drawstring bags, which were €8 each, which is insane. like we didn't know any better and this manufacturer kind of screwed us. Or getting labels done turned out to be like this thing that was a nightmare for us for whatever reason. It's fine now. We found a good manufacturer, but the first couple of...
Cost a fortune.
It was just complicated. We had one that like disappeared. Like they sent us like, we ordered size labels and they sent us like two of the sizes. We got the size 28 and a size medium. they just went, went missing. It was just crazy.
Yeah.
Actually this last season, the store, the shop, the collection that's in shops now, we delivered really late and we had all of these things going wrong on the back end of stuff where factories were late with their manufacturing and being disorganized and, sort of brushing us off because we're a small brand and kind of taking advantage of us because we're, we don't have the huge quantities. And then we got a new warehouse that was having their own logistical issues. And I think this was a big milestone learning moment for me as well, where it was like, okay, now it's time to step up and be a little bit more of the entrepreneur, business person.
Pragmatic person.
Let's play hardball.
Yeah.
We got to go in and send some angry emails and crack the whip and stop being so nice because I like to, maybe this is
you're
just
nice. You don't like conflict. Conflict.
Let's avoid it. It's like very passive. It's fine. It's fine. It's
gonna
fine.
It's gonna be okay.
Yeah, it's cool. We're all cool, man. Mm. It's cool, dude. Like whatever, man. It's totally not that at all. So, and then you have a crisis, and we really learned. Mm. I think this season that it's like, okay, if we're going to do business with you as a factory, this is what we need and you need to respect these things or it's on you. I've had this moment of, I guess, growing up or something, I finally feel like very adult in the way that I'm operating the business where, we're sending things and we're, arguing with the factories over invoices and saying things and trying to get things on time. These struggles that I think most business people do on a daily basis without thinking about it. And I mean, at least in other industries, maybe in fashion, that I just am not part of. But I kind of understand that side of the industry now in a much more serious way. So I think, you know, I mean, next season we're going to be, touch wood, but we're going to be super on time with everything.
Well done. And where do you want to bring this brand?
What's, where do I want to bring?
Yeah. What's your vision?
I mean, in terms of like the size, I kind of like the size of the collection, maybe a little bit bigger of stuff, but I think we have a lot of categories that I can add. Mm. You know, we haven't really touched on accessories or shoes or things like that. But to really build this full lifestyle around what we're, you know, this kind of ethos that we operate in, you know, this thing of where you can, we have our hiking stuff, you know, we do this collaboration with Mie.
Yeah.
So you have this very technical rain jackets and stuff that you can scale a mountain in.
Mm.
And then all the way down to having like a tuxedo even, you know, to really build everything that you're going to need in your daily life, in whatever context that might be as well. You know, I mean, one thing we're working on now that we're going to start incorporating the brand is even just vintage, you know, not even repurposed, cut up old, you know, Margiela kind of stuff. It's just vintage. Just, you know, you want a pair of jeans, get a nice pair of vintage jeans, whatever, you know, rather than us making everything new. It's more about the lifestyle and the sort of circularity of it all rather than us trying to make our own commercial version of something else that already exists.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's tackle this subject, sustainability.
Okay.
Where do you start? Where do you start? And because I've been digging this subject for a while now, and my conclusion is, don't start a brand if you don't want to make to destroy the planet, or just make super good products that lasts very long time, and people are gonna love it and take care of it for a long time. What is your view?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely that. You know, I think if you're going to make something new in this world, first of all, you have to do it as responsibly as possible in the way that your material sourcing and the factories you're choosing to partner with, and the way that, you know, like your process needs to be up to a certain level of just environmental awareness. And it should have a purpose. It should be literally needing to be brought into the world for something. So whether that's a special occasion, you know, like people are always going to have film premieres or weddings or whatever, a fancy night out or, you know, like a trip to go on, these kind of things. There's always going to be people living their lives. And so you have to either fulfill this and think about it sort of a purpose-driven thing, or don't make it. You know, don't start the brand. Don't even bother, because I think, you know, we need to slow down, I think. And it's a, you know, difficult thing to say, the fashion industry, which is all about commerce and growth and developing economies and sell, and every 6 months there's a whole new collection, but it doesn't matter, you know. I mean, just like, you don't need to replace your wardrobe every 6 months. You know, I hope people don't buy our whole collection. You know, they just buy a hoodie here and there, or a t-shirt, or a jacket, and they wear it for a long time. I'm really happy, you know. I've seen some people who bought the first collection and they're still wearing, you know, a friend of mine had this hoodie or this polo shirt that we did the very, very first season. And he'd worn it like so much, and it was like gray at this point, had been washed so much, and it, you know, it was really nice. That's 2 years, a year and a half, I guess, since he got it, and he's, you know, been just wearing it, and he loves it, and it's great. You know, I think this kind of attitude is very modern in the way that things are not even really seasonal, or it doesn't matter about the lifespan of a garment in terms of the fashion cycle.
Yeah.
It's more like in your own life, until you outgrow it, you don't like it anymore, mm. it doesn't really suit your lifestyle, you ruin it. I mean, this can also happen.
And when people ask you to what extent you are sustainable yourself?
I mean, that's an impossible question to answer, honestly, mm. because it's a bit like a Pandora's box. If once you start, you'll never end.
Mm.
You can nitpick your, you know, your business until you don't sleep at night anymore, and you're scared to do anything. Mm. And anything that you bring into the world is not a sustainable practice,
mm.
you know, unless it's already existing, because there's already enough clothes in the world.
Mm.
Then as long as you're doing that and using minimal energy, maybe that's sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're selling local vintage stuff, that's maybe the only sustainable fashion business practice yeah. that exists.
Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, we do at least try our best, you know, because I think sustainability is about intention. I think first and foremost, it's mm-hmm. about acknowledging that you're imperfect and trying to be better. And I think once people make that commitment and start trying to be better, sometimes it's misguided. Sometimes they don't really make it there.
Mm-hmm.
but you know, you see that people will pick, like, it's like, okay, well, at least we're going to use a small amount of organic products. Okay, that's it. Better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great. They're not going to give you a pat on the back about it, but you know, at least it's something. You're yeah. at least trying to have a conversation about it. And for us, yeah, we, I guess obviously our materials are all responsibly sourced. Mm-hmm. Our factories are working responsibly. We're very mindful of our carbon footprint, in the sense that we keep everything in Europe, the fabrics and the manufacturing. So mm-hmm. everything's, I don't want to call it local, but where it can be, it is.
Yeah. But for example, fabrics and well, yarn. Yarn yeah. is coming from
all over the place.
From all over the place.
But, you know, for example, we'll use like a knitter in Portugal
yeah.
and then the sweatshirts will be sewn
in Portugal or in Spain.
Yeah.
Yeah, not too far.
Exactly. Or mm. Italy will have like Italian woven fabrics
yeah.
made in Italy.
Okay.
You know, so this kind mm. of stuff.
But do you have a kind of strategy, a map of how we're going to tackle this all the subjects? And I mean, you cannot tackle everything at the same time. So
far away from yeah. everything. So I have a huge list of
things you want to do.
Things I want to do.
Yeah.
And then I just do the things that I can do
mm-hmm.
and worry about the rest when I get there, especially yeah. when we're only 2 years into starting a business.
And what would be the 20-80%, the 20-80 rules? You know this, yeah, the Pareto rule, you know, the 20-80. What are the 20% that have the 80% consequences on the sustainability part? What are the, well, asking the question differently would be, what is the most important things you can do when it comes to sustainability?
I mean, for me, the most important things are, yeah, the mm. materials
yeah.
and the manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
And the, yeah, all the materials that you use. So we use, we used recycled paper bags, for example, to ship the collection.
Yeah.
We're switching to this cornstarch based, like compostable, biodegradable mm-hmm. bag instead, because it's easier for the warehouse. Part of our shipping delays, paper bags.
Yeah.
So, yeah, now we're going to have these like biodegradable bags.
Mm.
Yeah. The fabrics, even the labels, our hang tags are recycled paper, you know, this kind of very mm. easy stuff. And then educating consumers, I think, mm. is another big part of it. Just showing them that it's also possible to care about the world and, you know, be cool, enjoy mm-hmm. fashion still, and, you know, not feel like they're giving up on something.
Yeah.
And then like furthering that, you know, let's talk like long-term goals a little bit, would be implementing blockchain and kind of a very digitally fully traceable
mm.
supply chain.
Yeah.
Are
you digging into it?
Yeah. You know, so having like you as this person who buys a shirt from us can, maybe there's a QR code or a little chip or something mm. that,
you know,
links you back to a thing that says, that the yarn was from this field in wherever it was grown. And, you know, the guy who picked its name was Steve, and, you know, the leather, and you can see exactly the cow that it came from and what they ate for lunch every day. You know, so you can get very, very specific. Not that I think 98% of the world gives a shit, to be honest, but 2% really will. And I think that will be important.
Yeah. And how shall we, I mean, how do you talk about it? I mean, it looks like in France, you know, and well, all over the place, you know, people don't really know. I mean, the fashion brands, at least the people who are showing during the Paris Fashion Week, they don't know how to talk about it. And it looks like they're a bit like, shall we not? Should we talk about it? How shall we do it? Et cetera, et cetera. And it looks, I mean, when you start a business, it may be a bit easier because this is part of your DNA, of your backbone. But when it comes to, let's talk about Jacquemus. Let's talk about Alexandre Mathusi. Let's talk about those people. You know, they've been into the business for quite a long time. They are a small business. You know, they don't do, I mean, they are not bad boys. You know, they are producing in Europe most of the time, a bit of China, etc.
They're not the bad guys.
They're not the bad guys.
They're not the good guys.
They're not the good guys.
Because they're not making it a priority. And they're at a place where it could be. I had the same thing with Dries actually as well.
Yeah. Because I think those people, you know, they've got the lights on themselves. They are very powerful.
Independent business, which means they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
You know, I understand Chanel might have a harder time, or Vuitton might have a harder time.
Okay.
Because they're huge companies. They have these mega factories. They're, you know, just like churning out these bags. I mean, like Vuitton, the whole business is built on a PVC based material. You know, I mean, in the long term, that's horrible, actually. Yeah. It's the worst material you could use. So for them to suddenly change to a bio-based whatever alternative to that, it's a massive business decision. And it's going to take some time for them to figure that out. So I get it, you know, and those ones. But it's these smaller businesses where, especially nowadays, you know, I mean, even in the 2 years I've started the business, it's become easier and easier to find, like, organic materials that I think a lot of businesses kind of have no excuse at this point to at least start doing it.
But maybe they started, but they don't talk about it.
Yeah, there are some that don't really, you know, I mean, all the Kering brands don't really do any.
But do you think they should talk about it?
I don't know. That's a harder question to answer, because, I mean, you could use the example of the Nike versus Adidas. You know, those are two companies that are really leading the way in terms of sustainability for a huge corporation. I mean, Adidas talks about it very openly. They do that Parley for the Oceans. That's like sustainability reports. They're really putting it out there. Nike, not a word. It's like they don't want people to know about it or discover that. Or if they do, it's, you know, maybe like a little thing, but it's an interesting thing because it's very different strategies in terms of dealing with public relations in regards to your sustainability. And I know other brands do sustainable stuff. You know, I mean, there's, all the Kering brands have sustainability in their portfolio of stuff. You know, there's materials, they do use organic cottons and things, but they don't talk about it because they don't think consumers care about it, or they don't want to, or it diminishes the luxury aspect or something.
But don't you think that they've got, I mean, my point of view, this is my point of view, I think brands have got a responsibility to talk about it, to make, to start a bigger movement that is starting already. My point of view is, okay, people will stop drinking into plastic bottle when the cool guys will drink into the gourd, or, I don't know, in English. And in that sense, I think the brands, I mean, the fashion brands, they are the cools, right?
Yeah.
So they've got a power to make the coolness spread into the whole population.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of responsibility on fashion brands, you know, because we are meant to be, like you said, kind of leading the way and showing the example of trends to come. And I also think that it's a really amazingly luxurious thing to have a responsible product. You know, I think that, to me, is the definition of a modern luxury. It's, you see it in food. You know, what's the most sort of luxurious supermarket to go to in the US? That's Whole Foods. It's organic everything, you know, like bio salt and just like absurdly, you know, sort of hilarious products that are just incredibly, environmentally responsible. The sort of more responsible it is, the better it is for the, you know, for consumers.
Yeah.
And I would like to see that same thing happen in the fashion industry, where the most luxurious garments are the most ethically made. And, you know, if you're going to get cheap, bad stuff, it's going to be from H&M, and it's, you know, it's all plastic and weird and bad for the environment. I mean, obviously these high fashion, high street companies are horrible and they kind of need to go. Because, I mean, H&M is also a really confusing one because they did a, what's it called? The conscious collection.
Yeah. Which is full of bullshit.
It's an absolute, it's absolute bullshit. It's literally, thank you for your effort, but your entire business model is exactly the thing that's wrong with this entire industry. So until they're out of business, they can't really, you know, contribute to a better
world.
No. you know, just if you make it out of organic cotton, you're still selling it at $15 for, you know, €7, terribly made in some sweatshop. So defeats the purpose. But I think, I mean, I'm seeing more and more, brands starting to have this conversation. You know, I think little bits and pieces, you know, Prada doing their re-nylon, or they just had this thing where they did cords, Prada cords, which is cool. Or Sarah Burton's last collection for McQueen was interesting. Because she tried to make it a big kind of ethical, like, craft thing using linen that's very artisanally made, which I think is amazing. You know, I mean, on a certain level, like, Hermes is a very ethical company, sort of by accident. You know, I don't think anyone sat down and said, okay, well, how can we be more conscious of our process? It's, you know, it's sort of just the way that they've always done it is by hand, quite local, artisanally made, very, like, high quality fabrics, things that you wear for generations, even, you know, bags that you keep for your whole life. And that is a very ethical way of working and kind of sustainable in the overall sense. And I don't know. I think it would be nice if we can get everyone on board for that.
And how can we accelerate this process?
Try harder. I think some people and some brands really have to do a little bit of soul searching and stop talking about it and just sit down and fucking do it. You know, I think this last fashion week was really interesting to watch because I mean, if you were paying attention, there was, everybody was talking about sustainability, but then you would see the collections or sort of like you'd start to peel back that veneer of stuff. You go, what are you talking about? You know? It's interesting that people are trying, they're sort of doing the press release with doing the minimal effort. And I think it would be nice if, you know, it were possible to not do 100% effort if it's going to be too much for you, but you make a bigger effort for sure. You know, especially the smaller brands. I think that's even less of an excuse. If you don't have a board of directors to, you know, or shareholders or anything, you know, I mean, like Ralph Lauren would be, God, that would be such a difficult business to make fully eco.
Yeah, when you own your business 100% or... 80%.
And your quantities are like small enough and easy enough to kind of maneuver around. I think you're definitely needing to think bigger picture about these things. You know, and I think it's, you're having less and less of an excuse not to. Because, you know, I mean, when we started, it was, yeah, it was hard, but not impossible. And we did it. And it was basically just me figuring it out. You know, if you have a production person and a fabric development person and enough, and, you know, enough support, it's easy. It's just a couple of phone calls. You might have to pay a little bit more. Your margin might be temporarily lower than normal, but it'll work out. You know, I think in the long term, I think it's worth the investment. You know, you're not killing our planet. Is
definitely. And where do you see yourself in 10 years?
10 years. Well,
if somebody gives you a art direction of a brand, would you take it?
Depends on the brand, but why not? Sure. I would like to keep Phipps going.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would do both. I mean, I would stop one to do the other one. Just because I think Phipps for me is the more long-term, like, I don't know, it's more, yeah, long-term steady thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a job at a whatever thing and 3 years in, they fire you, then you're fired. You
know, yeah. That's true.
But if I can keep Phipps forever, then
yeah,
I mean, that's like my little bit, my legacy. But I hope to. I think we have the potential to go long term on this one. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't really plan that long into the future. Like I said, when I was, you know, started the brand, I didn't really think much beyond just like, let's see if people like it and you know, go from there. So I kind of take each season by a little, just sort of cross my fingers and like hope we do a little bit better. You know, I have a 5-year plan, which is, to build the business and kind of get it steady and kind of, I can picture that. 10 years, I couldn't tell you. I mean, would I still be in France? I mean, who knows?
Would you like to go back to your country?
No, I don't. Honestly, on a day-to-day, it changes. You know, France has been cool.
Yeah.
It's been really positive. But obviously, America is where I'm from.
Yeah. You know. Do you miss America?
I think so. Yeah, I do. I don't know if I miss it because I'm not there, you know, miss it in absentia versus like if I was actually there, if I would like it as much on the day to day. But I do. I mean, I miss California.
Of course.
Yeah. It's an incredible place.
Do you think, what would it look like if Phipps were born in the US, were born in California?
I don't think we would have the recognition that we have today. I think we would be like a direct consumer Instagram brand. That kind of a thing. I don't think we would have the wholesale accounts that we have now or any of the kind of cachet that we're having in the industry. You know, I mean, I thought about it because when I started thinking about the brand, I was still living in Belgium. And I knew I wasn't going to stay in Belgium. I mean, I'm not from there. I wasn't working for a company there. So it was, I was going to leave. And I was in an interesting position because I could have started the business anywhere. You know, like I could have gone back to New York, could have gone to LA, could have gone to, I don't know, somewhere really random. Could go to Italy, maybe, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I speak zero Italian. I decided France because I speak a bit of French. I had a couple of friends here. You know, in terms of menswear, it's like the most serious
place,
industry, and I kind of know my way around Paris, so it made sense. But yeah, we thought about it. You know, I remember thinking about maybe doing it out of LA. I didn't want to go back to New York. I didn't want to live there anymore. I did 10 years. It was enough. I don't need to live there again.
Too intense.
Yeah, it was, I don't know. I mean, it just wasn't for me. It was nice to get out. And not maybe LA, but I don't know. I think to keep it interesting for people, it's more interesting for us to be based out of France and to be doing this from Paris, you know, in the context of just menswear conversation in general, I think we would have just disappeared in LA.
Why you decided to go into the wholesale? Why? I mean, you were talking about direct-to-consumer brands going into Instagram. You could have done this from Paris as well.
I could have. Yeah. I mean, I still can do it.
Yeah.
We were going... The original idea was to kind of do both. Do wholesale and direct-to-consumer. And we, I guess, lucky enough, got really good wholesale.
Very quickly.
Really quickly. You know, normally you do direct-to-consumer because you don't have the wholesale.
Yeah.
And we've been really lucky with our wholesale. And a lot of them are online wholesale as well. You know, I mean, Matches is a very strong online, it's all online. But, you know, so we have a really good presence through online retailers. So we didn't really need to push the web shop on our end that much. For now, you know, I mean, we never really like do that much turnover on our web shop. It's interesting because it's counterintuitive, but everyone I think just goes on Essence and buys it there, where, you know, they go online, find it from a better shop. So my plan is, I scaled it back a lot recently. In the last 6 months, we kind of really took it down to the bare minimums. We just got some like bandanas and water bottles and stuff up there right now. And the idea is to take it back. And then redo the whole website and build a proper, like with the warehouse, build a infrastructure, have someone there, kind of a customer service, like retail, online retail management person who can just have that be their job. Cause it's kind of a full-time thing. You know, you have to answer the emails and manage the orders and the shipping and stocks and all this, you know, it's a complicated thing. So if I can have somebody manage it and have it look nice, and we have now a little bit the community, I guess is the word, that will respond if we come back in 6 months time or in a year and we say, hey, check out this amazing new web shop that we just did, and then we can really go for it and do both. But in the meantime, I don't really want to compete with our wholesalers because it's nice to build that relationship. You know, and we've been very lucky enough. We've been very strong with that.
What impressed you? Is there anybody who impressed you right now in the industry?
I mean, so many people.
Really? Yeah.
I think even more so now. Like, I was impressed with people in the industry at the beginning, but even more so now that I've started a business, I know how insanely difficult it is. I'm kind of just impressed by anybody who can have a business. You know, I mean, if you can make something and you've got a customer base that's going to buy it, I think that's really impressive. You know, even if I think the product itself is super weird or I don't get it, if you've got people that get it and they want to buy it, they want to spend lots of money on it, that's super cool. You know, so maybe I'm easily impressed in that sense, but I don't know. I think there's a lot of really, really amazing people in the industry. That's one thing that kind of keeps me here. Is even behind the scenes, or, you know, sort of, again, the people that have been supportive or trying to help or looking to do whatever on any end of stuff. I mean, you know, it's been really, I'm constantly impressed by how positive people have been.
What would you do differently?
What would I do differently?
Yeah.
I would do a bunch of stuff differently, I think. I would organize a little bit better, I think. You know, it's all these mistakes. I think each season we learn a little bit more about the process. And I mean, I guess at the time, you know, I don't really have any regrets in the sense of like the way that I did the business, because I did the best I could with the information that I had at the time through the whole process. And I think for that, you can't really beat yourself up about it. But looking back, it's like I would have done a couple of different things differently. I would have, you know, developed this collection a little bit differently. I could have, you know, hindsight is always 20/20, as they say. So it's, yeah, you could always look back and say, oh, I could have done this and that and that. But it's hard to say, because if I didn't, I wouldn't be here now, you know? So it's, I don't know if I would really do anything differently, as much as I would like to say that.
What is your favorite place in Paris?
My studio, my apartment.
Yeah, yeah. What does it look like?
Well, I have a very cute apartment. It's actually just around the corner from here. It's a little duplex. It's got this great bathroom, and it like kind of looks over. It's a very Paris apartment. You get the rooftops. So you get the little light from the Eiffel Tower.
Nice.
Yeah, it's really cute.
Look at you. Okay. Is there anything you want to add into this interview? It's been an hour and a half already.
Okay. I can't think of anything. So, anything else? Any last questions from you that you can think of?
I think I know what I wanted to know.
Okay. Okay.
But no, it could last forever. I mean, could last forever, definitely. Usually I close the interview asking who would like you to listen. Okay, let's do it in French. Qui souhaiterais-tu entendre dans ce podcast?
Have you had Glenn?
Glenn Martens?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. No, I'd love to do it.
You should get in touch with him. He's really funny.
Yeah. And very nice and very...
Yeah. He's like...
You will do that,
conversation
yeah.
with him. Like, he's very, very good for conversation. I think that would be fun.
Cool. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to welcome you in my apartment. Next time we'll do it in your apartment. Take care. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Merci d'avoir écouté Entreprendre dans la mode. Si l'épisode vous a plu, je vous invite à laisser un message aux invités directement sur leurs réseaux sociaux pour les remercier de leurs bons conseils et de leur générosité. C'est très important pour montrer que Entreprendre dans la mode est vraiment écouté. Tout aussi important, abonnez-vous au podcast et laissez un avis sur Apple Podcast ou iTunes, 5 étoiles de préférence, car ça permet à Entreprendre dans la mode de rester en haut du classement et d'être donc découvert par de plus en plus de gens. Et surtout, ça me motive à faire de meilleures interviews. Il n'y a pas de pub sur ce podcast. Entreprendre dans la mode est financé par ses auditeurs sur patreon.com. Vous pouvez vous aussi rejoindre cette communauté et soutenir Entreprendre dans la mode à partir de 2€ par mois en allant sur patreon.com/entreprendre dans la mode. Le lien est dans la description de l'épisode. Enfin, pour ne rien rater de l'actualité de Entreprendre dans la mode, vous pouvez me suivre sur Instagram en cherchant Entreprendre dans la mode. Merci de soutenir ce podcast et à mardi prochain pour un nouvel épisode.